Hello, and welcome to TwerpCast, episode 43. TrekCast, Inspirations. Inspirations is our fourth annual participation in the 12 Trek Days of Christmas. Usually, I say something witty, or an attempt at something witty at this point, which I'm not going to do this year. Thinking of inspirations to me has made me realize that we've actually lost the Thanksgiving holiday. We go right from October 31st to November 1st Christmas decorations and Christmas sales. And even though Black Friday is the Friday after Thanksgiving, you've already had 3 to 4 weeks worth of Christmas shopping to do. So I want to tell you the things that I'm thankful for because I think, really, I missed Thanksgiving. I am thankful for you, the listeners, and I'm thankful that we bring something to you. And I'm glad that that is some sort of an inspiration. I'm also thankful for the two gentlemen that will be joining us with TrekCast Inspirations this year, co-executive producer James Caswell and special correspondent Ken Halloran. We share something in common with Star Trek. Again, something for me to be thankful for. Star Trek is an all-inclusive universe. It has the feeling of everyone can be included. If the Klingons are the bad guys in one generation, they're the good guys in the next generation. Well, the three of us, the gentlemen here today, are all of different faiths. And at one time or another, there have been bloody battles between our faiths. I won't go into it. That's not really the point of it. The point is, like Star Trek, we live in a world where we are inclusive, that we can be three of the closest people on the planet. And that's what I'm thankful for this year. So for TrekCast Inspirations, I would like to now introduce you to executive producer James Caswell.
That was very nice. He is Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of TWERPS. As any Trekkie or Trekker will attest, Star Trek has had a dramatic impact on society, but it goes way beyond fandom. Star Trek has been the inspiration for many ideas and technology we take for granted today. Many of the great minds of the 20th century claim that they were inspired by Trek. Take, for example, some of the devices that we take for granted on a daily basis. The design for your average flip cell phone is based off of the communicators from the original series.
We have medical advances that come directly from Star Trek. Unfortunately, no pills that regrow kidneys, but we do have diagnostic tables that let you see the inside of a person without opening them up. We have MRIs. We have CAT scans.
Which is a direct tie to the diagnostic table that was used by Dr. McCoy.
There's now rapid heart scans where, much like you can take a CAT scan of the brain, you can take a CAT scan of the heart in between beats. Now they have ultrasounds that they don't just let you hear the sound of the baby's heartbeat, but it can take a picture of the baby in utero. Other devices.
Well, there's one bit of technology that was inspired by Star Trek and has actually since been obsoleted, the computer disc.
I think it's actually kind of funny. They used computer discs in Star Trek, and just as you said, that was science fiction at the time. We used them for a good 20 years, and now they're no longer necessary.
We've moved past them.
Our need for information at our fingertips has grown beyond the capabilities of those disks. Back when the floppy disk was first introduced, people didn't see any need to have anything beyond 360K. Now you have people who walk around with thumb drives that can store up to 64 gig.
In the original series, they were using what amounted to floppy disks to carry their information around. By the time the next generation had come around, now they were using isolinear chips, much more like those USB thumb drives.
I'm a big enough geek that I often refer to my thumb drive as a isolinear rod or chip. But then again, I'm a huge geek.
Yeah, what I call my rod, you don't want to know. Take other devices like the personal access display device, the pad. Jim, what can you think of that has come out of the pad?
Let's see. We've got the iPad. We've got the Nook. We've got the Kindle. Those are just off the top of my head. That doesn't even count the iPhone, which combines both the pad and the communicator.
I'm waiting for them to come up with one called the iQuarter, as opposed to a tricorder.
Well, They are actually coming out with an app for the iPhone that allows you to pee on a chip, insert it into your phone, and it will tell you if you have an STD.
There are a host of medical iPhone and iPad applications. There literally are devices which you could attach to the end of an iPhone. That with the little device, you put the EKG monitors, those little sticky pads that they give you in the doctor's office, and you can phone your doctor your EKG.
That one bothers me less than the whole peeing on something and then putting it in your phone.
Yes, you put this chip that you've peed on inside of your phone where it gets nice and warm.
They call it the eye golden shower.
It was very popular with the Zeus.
Well, right now, diabetics are using jet injectors instead of syringes, just like Dr. McCoy would use his hypo spray.
The jet injectors are still considered brand new technology. It hasn't gotten to the point of everyday use like a lot of these other things, but it isn't that far away, and it is preferred by a lot of people because you don't end up actually having to pierce the skin. Less chance of infection, less chance of
pain.
And less chance of spreading any blood-related diseases.
Now that's just the medical field alone. Star Trek has brought us advances in other scientific areas. Physics of Star Trek is one of the most impressive things in the world. It has inspired minds to think outside the box. When people said the world was flat, Christopher Columbus sailed and said it was round. Okay, that's actually a wives' tale. Nobody ever thought the world was flat. But you get the point. The scientific community really believed you couldn't pass the speed of sound. Chuck Yeager proved them wrong.
In 1966, the idea of traveling to the moon was science fiction. Never had happened. A lot of people thought it would never happen, let alone space exploration. I remember watching an interview with Ray Bradbury where he was talking about back in the 60s, people would laugh at him as a science fiction author about the fact that he would write about outer space and man traveling through the stars and other planets and things of that nature. And with each and every one of them, he would ask them for their name and for their phone number. And the night we landed on the moon, he called each and every one of those people to tell them, see, this is what I was talking about.
I wonder what those people say about the hundreds of extrasolar planets we've discovered.
They're not extra. We have just enough. There's no coincidence that the prototype for the space shuttle was called the USS Enterprise. That was the direct influence of a write-in campaign of Star Trek fans that was in the hundreds of thousands, near the million mark.
And yet NASA still felt the need to try to sell a cock and bull story about it being named after the warship.
To show how on the mark Star Trek was, Gene Roddenberry managed to predict to the day, if not the date, of when man would reach the moon. The episode Tomorrow is Yesterday told the story of the Enterprise traveling back to 1969. During a news broadcast on the show, it talked about Apollo 11 launching this Wednesday. Apollo 11 launched July 16th, 1969, which was a Wednesday.
He had a 1 in 7 chance of getting that right. I'm just saying.
True, but considering the fact that the experts at the time of the production of that episode said that we wouldn't be getting into outer space until at least 1970, the fact that he said 1969 and that was accurate was still a pretty good guess.
Now I'm looking at our agenda, Jim and Ken, and it's called Star Trek Empires Theoreticians. And you've got these marked as trying to apply real-world science to recreate things on Trek. And some of them, I would say, in reality, actually like border on existing, they're just not there yet. For instance, it talks about cloaking devices. Cloaking devices themselves have been proven 100% possible. There's a very interesting show on the Science Channel on this very subject. I recommend our listeners try and find it on the internet. It was amazing. It was an accident found by the way magnetics actually warp around superconductors. And then the theoretician said, well, if we can do it with magnetic waves, we should be able to do this with light waves. And so they went on to prove, yes, they can do this with light waves. So there's a couple of problems with the technology the way it exists now. Number one, Exactly like in the Star Trek universe, it uses an immense amount of power. To get this to work, you would practically need to carry your own nuclear vessel with you. But the second problem is, the way the light warping technology works at the moment is it's actually pinpoint. So if you pick a wavelength, that wavelength will literally warp around an object. This is the time for me where radio is so hard, because I want to draw a circle around an object and just show that the light really does start at one side of the circle, go all the way around, and come back out the other side in a straight line. And whatever's in the center of the circle is effectively invisible. But it's pinpoint. So if you say a particular shade of blue is what you're blocking, that's all that would disappear. So you would need a cloaking device for every shade of blue, for every shade of red, for every shade of green. And then once you built the cloaking device that actually masters the entire visible spectrum, at least to the human eye, you realize all those light beams that were coming towards you have warped around you. You are effectively in a bubble of darkness. So there's still a couple of problems to go with this, but they've proven beyond just theory, you can warp light and make something inside of it effectively invisible.
Like H.G. Wells predicted, blind.
Transporters. Okay, I admit pushing the limit on this, but there is a theoretical physicist in Australia who has beamed an atom. Goes a long way from beaming an atom to beaming all of the atoms in the human structure, putting them back together and keeping the consciousness intact.
But it's a start.
We still got another 200 years.
Holographic projections. They have the technology to actually do... not a 3D television set like we see now, where you put on the glasses and you see the 3D image, but an actual 3D laser-projected image. Again, you got to look this up on the internet, but it sets up in a circle a series of laser projectors. And they're the red, green, blue, just like a television set. And the laser projectors move around so fast that it creates a holographic projection in the center. Again, we're at the very beginning of the technology. The circle that we're talking about, maybe an inch or two square, so not really practical unless you want a holographic watch. The last one that I want to hit on that we're talking about as a theoretical thing is replicators. I don't know what the machinery is called right now. It's a very basic technology, but essentially what it is it's a printer that can print a solid object. So the basis for this replicator technology is there's the 3D laser scan of an object. The 3D laser image is sliced like an MRI into very small sections. And what happens is in your printer box, the print heads go across the very top layer of fine plastic particles. And it heats them up and those plastic particles melt. The box itself raises up a fraction of an inch. The printhead goes across again, melts another layer of very fine particles to the first layer of particles, etc., etc., etc. It repeats this process for each slice. Then when you drain the remaining fine particles out of the box, what you have is pieces of plastic which have been melted in the exact shape of the object that was scanned. Again, pushing the technology because all you're really doing is making an exact 3D sculpture of an object.
I would not want to eat that apple.
Correct. But it's the start of the technology. And if you could do this, say, with fine metal shavings, then you could replicate all the parts you need to build, say, a watch. And so on and so forth. Eventually the technology will get there. But we have the start of something already.
All plastic is of complex hydrocarbons, which is what most of our food is, too. Not the same ones, but they aren't actually all that far apart.
Well, my lay opinion would be, when we learn to change those complex hydrocarbons, the printer head will, instead of just melting them, it will change them and melt them.
It would also explain the food of burpee.
So, I picked those specific items because, not only are they theoretical, but we actually have a start on getting there. That makes me believe that, maybe not in my lifetime, but by the 23rd or 24th century, it's possible these items will exist.
Will they use tractor beams in farming?
I honestly don't see why not.
It would make things easier. So, yes, your bad pun would work.
I would think that the use, honestly, of tractor beams and the bad pun of farming would all come down to the way farming actually works today.
It's all about energy and consumption. A cow requires so much food to grow. So you have to have a fine mathematical formula. How much food, medicine, shelter will cost to grow your cow over a lifetime for either are you going to use the cow as a dairy cow or are you going to use it as beef cattle? And again, it's how much money do you spend on grain? I mean, there is an energy intake that you're going to get to grow that cattle, and then you're going to change that energy into gold-pressed latinum. Same thing applies to the tractor beams. There's so much energy that you're going to get out of, let's say, a cornfield. It took you so much energy to plow the cornfields and to grow the corn. Is it more or less cost efficient to use a tractor beam to literally create holes in the field and then pick the corn? Or are they going to use migrant labor from planet fill in the blank?
Or somebody else going to find us and use us as the migrant labor?
The subject of a great deal of science fiction movies and or books and stories.
Not to mention those that are going to use us for the energy source.
How to serve man.
I've tried to pick some areas that we're already working on. What do you think are some areas that we have yet to go?
Well, at the moment, there are scientists that are trying to convert the loosely described warp theory and turn it into a reality. They have learned that, yes, a warp bubble would have to be created to allow a ship to be transported at extreme speeds. One of the theories is that that warp bubble that gets created does not propel the ship forward at extreme speeds. It holds the ship in place while the universe rotates around it. That's a little bit higher levels of scientific theory than I'm capable of fully grasping, but it sounds neat.
That could work. Something like the planet Earth moves at 27,000 miles per hour. If you could hold something still in front of it, it would come upon you really quickly.
As they get further into trying to blend general relativity, special relativity, quantum theory, and Einstein's theory of gravity all into the grand unified theory, they do believe that it is possible that the speed of light may not actually be a constant. That depending on the amount of curvature there is to space-time in the general neighborhood might actually affect how fast the speed of light is.
I read the same article, and it actually makes sense if you think about it kind of as an analogy. Think of air and air volume. Things can move at a certain speed through air volume. We call that critical velocity. If you increase the volume of air in the space, your maximum velocity decreases. If you decrease the volume of air in that space, your maximum velocity increases. The same theory basically would hold true for time-space. If you have a greater amount of time-space, lesser amount of time-space, light would take a different amount of time to travel through it. And that is as basic as I can get because the mathematics are so far beyond me.
Planetary classification. I hit upon a little while ago, they are finding hundreds of planets outside of our solar system. And so far, these are only just the big ones. They are still looking for Earth-like planets, Earth-sized planets, what have you. And what they're finding is there are a lot more types of planets than what we have in our little neck of the woods. And as such, they are working on a classification system so they can say, this type of world is this kind of planet, this type of world is that. They are trying to catalog all these different types, and with all the hundreds of extrasolar planets they found, they need to have some kind of filing system for them. And Star Trek indicated that they had one 4 decades ago.
This particular subject contains one of my biggest pet peeves in astrophysics. There is a new term that they are now using called the Goldilocks zone. And I understand exactly what it means, but I hate the term.
What they used to just call the green zone?
Exactly. I prefer the green zone, even if it is made of humans. It's basically the idea is, if you are on one side of the Goldilocks zone, it's too hot. If you're on the other side of the Goldilocks zone, it's too cold. But any planet that is found within the Goldilocks zone is just right.
So the way Venus is too hot and Mars is too cold and Earth is just right?
Yes. Like you said, it used to be called the Green Zone, and then somebody got clever and changed it to Goldilocks Zone.
What actually happened is they found one of these extrasolar planets They realized that all their measurements were right, that the planet was in the green zone, and they actually started referring to the Goldilocks planet because the planet was going to be just right. They've actually revised their assessment of the planet by either way. But it's actually using the term Goldilocks there that has led to the term being more generic and referring to the Goldilocks zone. And yeah, it's really kind of annoying.
For those of you who want to know all the other things about Goldilocks, please read The Fourth Bear by Jasper Ford.
Good plug.
And just the amount of information that we've learned about a black hole within the past 40 years is impressive. The fact that people just used to think that it was just a collapsed star that debris would go into and would disappear, that theory is starting to be examined a little bit more closely, and people are wondering what actually happens to that matter.
I hate to say this wrong. Usually on TrekCast, I don't mind being wrong, but this is one of those times. But essentially, if you have a large black area space that defies logic, where there should be planets, it's that absence that is one of the areas of proof. The other area of proof is the gravitic lens effect. And unlike the Goldilocks zone, I actually like the name of this one. And it goes almost directly along the lines of the cloaking device we were talking about earlier. The gravity of a black hole is so powerful that it is possible that the light from directly behind a black hole will be pulled around to one side and pulled around to the other side. So you'll look at an area of space that is a mirror image with a hole in the center. And that is what I believe is their current method of proof, is finding exact mirror images with a hole in the center.
Usually I hear the gravitic lens thing being mentioned when they're talking about dark matter, and I hate the theory of dark matter.
This is Doug's prediction for 2010. There is no such thing as dark matter. Dark matter is something that scientists are using right now to explain a missing portion of the grand unification theory. That we will find that there's not one thing called dark matter, but there are several smaller pieces that when you put them in place, will make up for what we now call dark matter.
And possibly contradict St. Isaac and St. Albert?
Yes, definitely. I'm not saying that I'm smart enough to do it, but what I am saying is eureka. I can't describe it in mathematical form, but I'm willing to say eureka.
Okay, so you're saying dark matter doesn't exist. I say that omega matter never should have existed.
You're absolutely correct.
Then, of course, there's the theory of time travel, which is not solely a Star Trek thing, but they've used it in enough plot points and one of their most successful movies that it bears at least mentioning. The theory of time travel is almost always a hot topic among the theoreticians. A lot of people say there will never be time travel because we've not seen any evidence of time travel. And then other people make the argument that because we don't have time travel, the people who are time traveling are going out of their way to make sure that we don't notice them. Kind of like the whole alien theory. But there have been some theorists who believe that, yes, time travel will be a possibility once we can develop the power to support it.
My thought on that is, if the theoretical ability for there to be multiple universes exists, then time travel does exist. And the reason that we don't have evidence of it is because every time somebody time travels, they are creating another universe.
I know that a lot of the theoretical math it involved says time travel should be possible. There are lots of questions that get raised, the so-called grandfather paradox, etc., etc., but there are people who work on it.
Well, we're pretty sure that we can move forward in time.
Oh, we're definitely moving forward in time. Second per second, pretty consistently.
Thank you, Ken. I will clarify my statement. People who travel closer to the speed of light, they have a time dilation effect where time travels slower for them than it does for people who are traveling at what we will call X velocity, what people on Earth are, a constant. And that if they travel far enough away at a percentage of the speed of light and then travel back to Earth, the people on Earth will have progressed further than the people on the spaceship.
And that's not just theory. They have actually proven that it works. It's just on small scale involving things like trips to the moon. We're just getting up to the thousands of miles per hour used by our rockets. they're time dilated and slightly less time occurred for them than did for us.
They've actually also proved that gravity affects the rate of time passage thanks to the modern technology of atomic clocks. If you set two atomic clocks, put them at absolutely precise synchronization, and you keep one at sea level, and you put one in geosynchronous orbit, they lose their synchronicity.
And speaking of time, I think ours is just about up. As long as there is a Star Trek, a new generation of scientists will be inspired to reach for the stars and the future.
Have a happy and safe holiday season, folks. Happy Christmas, Merry Hanukkah, and Merry New Year.
And as always, thank you for listening to the TwerpCast. We encourage your feedback. Please write to us at jim@twerponline.net. We can also be found at Facebook, MySpace, Zanga, and Twitter.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2010.
Happy Chinookah.